And it gives me great pleasure to introduce tonight's speaker, Sir John Mason. Sir John is a very distinguished scientist whose research interests have been in the field of climate. He's famous internationally for his work on the behaviour of clouds and rain and snow and lightning, subjects of interest to us all, although few of us know anything about it except him. He was, in fact, very close to the public weal because he was Director General of the Meteorological Office from 1965 to 1983. And he has a number of jobs, although he's supposedly retired. He's Senior Advisor to Imperial College in problems of environmental change, and that's very appropriate because before he went to the Met Office, he was in fact a professor at Imperial. And he's also recently had the enormous distinction of becoming Chancellor of what we all know as UMIS, the University of Science and Technology in Manchester. Sir John has received many, many honorary degrees and awards and distinctions for his work, especially from the Royal Society, who elected him a fellow at a very early age. He's had a number of their extremely prestigious medals, and in the later years he was the senior vice president of the Royal and its treasurer, and as far as I know, it's still in very good financial state. His current work is particularly concerned with climate modelling and climate change, so it's extremely appropriate, and we could have no better lecturer to talk on this topic of global warming and climate change, fact or fiction. Sir John Mason.
Professor Lambert, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. It's a real pleasure to come such a short distance to give a lecture. I don't think in my long lecture career I've ever had a and to be chaired by my next door neighbour who lives just opposite me. So that's an added pleasure. It does recall a somewhat similar occasion a long time ago when I was invited by the University of Reading to give a public lecture. And the Vice Chancellor, who I should say was a slightly rough diamond, got up and said, "Well, you remember last year, ladies and gentlemen, that we had a distinguished scientist from the United States who insisted on coming by Concorde. This year, we thought we'd better invite somebody a little nearer home." "Yes," I said, "it's only 8p on the bus from the Met Office cottage to the campus, and I was the lowest tender." Well, there is widespread concern and worry that man-made emissions of infrared-absorbing gases like carbon dioxide, methanes, and the CFCs from the aerosol cans may lead to an enhancement of the natural greenhouse effect. I'll describe what the greenhouse effect is in a moment. And may lead to global warming of the atmosphere, and also changes in other aspects of the climate, like the rainfall, the snow and ice cover, the rise in sea level, soil moisture, and so on. Unfortunately, the subject has become very controversial, and I think it's become overhyped, in my opinion, and certainly distorted by the media. So I think there's quite a lot of confusion about what the scientific basis for the concern is. Not only, I might say, among the general public, but even among professional scientists themselves. And as you know, there's just last week finished a big ministerial conference in Berlin where ministers came from 120 countries for a week to decide what they were going to do, if anything, about CO2 emissions beyond the year 2000. The meeting was somewhat of a fiasco, I believe. Very little was decided. But I'll give you my views about what might be done or what should be done a little later on when I have discussed with you the scientific aspects of the subject. Now, of course, there's no doubt that the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is increasing. It has increased steadily since the Industrial Revolution, and it's increased by about 27% since 1860. And is increasing at the moment at about 0.5% per annum. Now, if that continues, and it has been until the last very few years accelerating, if this continued, and certainly if the world population continues to increase at anything like the present rate, then there will come a time when the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere, for example, will double somewhere towards the middle or the latter part of the next century. And so it's not really a question of whether the greenhouse effect is being enhanced. It is. But the main question is, what is the magnitude and the timing of the effect as far as the climate is concerned? Are the climate changes likely to be so large and so imminent that governments now have to take some really major action? Or are they likely to be sufficiently small or sufficiently delayed that we can either live with them or adapt to them? They really are the questions which need to be answered. And I think the best thing perhaps I can do for you this evening is to summarize for you our latest views about what we understand about the natural climate, what makes the actual climate work, what the man-made impacts may be, how we predict those. And perhaps just as important to tell you is the uncertainties which are involved in the predictions of what the climate may be 50 or 100 years' time. Well, let me start by saying that the natural greenhouse effect is a terribly important part of the natural climate. Now, when I talk about the Earth's climate system, I mean the atmosphere, the oceans, the land surface, the biosphere, the trees and the vegetation, and the land and sea ice, the glaciers, the land-based ice, and the sea ice. All of those together make the climate system, and they all interact with one another in a very complex and complicated way. But we have to treat that whole system if we're going to be able to understand and predict what's going to happen to the climate. Now, this big global system is driven by energy from the sun. The incoming solar radiation to the top of the atmosphere, if it's averaged over day and night and over all latitudes and over all seasons, is 340 watts on every square meter. So if you think of a square meter of 300 watt bulbs and a 40 watt bulb shining on that all the time, that's the total amount of energy that's coming into the Earth's atmosphere from the sun. And that's equivalent to 340 megawatts on every square kilometer. So you can think of a square kilometer and a medium-sized power station on each of that. So, I mean, the amounts of energy involved are tremendous. Now, as that incoming radiation from the sun comes through the atmosphere, some of it is reflected back by clouds and scattered back by the gases into the atmosphere to outer space. Some is absorbed. And only about half of it gets down to the Earth's surface. And it warms the Earth's surface, and then the Earth itself radiates heat back towards outer space. But of course the Earth's temperature is much lower than that of the Sun. The Sun is 6,000 degrees and the Earth's surface is only about 15 degrees centigrade. So the radiation which the Earth radiates back is not the visible light that you see from the Sun, but it's invisible infrared radiation, as you would get from a fire. That radiation, if there were no greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, no carbon dioxide, no water vapor, no ozone, that would escape to space. And then the Earth's surface temperature, on average, would be minus 19 degrees centigrade. It is, in fact, plus 15. If you average it over the whole Earth and over all seasons, the average temperature of the Earth is plus 15. So you see there's a 34 degree centigrade difference due to this greenhouse effect, because these gases, carbon dioxide and water vapor in the atmosphere, absorb this infrared radiation on its way to space. Only about 8% of it escapes and gets right through. The rest of it is absorbed by the carbon dioxide and the water vapor. Water vapor is even more important than carbon dioxide, by the way. And then it radiates a lot of that back to the Earth again and keeps the Earth 34 degrees centigrade warmer than it otherwise would be. So that's the natural greenhouse effect. And if we didn't have that, this would be a frozen, lifeless planet. So we mustn't knock the greenhouse effect The concern is whether man, by putting carbon dioxide, additional carbon dioxide, and greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, enhances that natural greenhouse effect, overcooks it slightly, and gives us an additional warming to what we would normally have. So that's what we mean by the greenhouse effect. Now, as I said, the CO, the carbon dioxide is increasing. There's no doubt about that. I think it would be best if I had the lights off, and I'll just tell them.
See that?
Spot, can you? Yes. Well, this is the carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, as I said, has increased 27% since 1860, but it's been measured every day since 1958, very accurately indeed, mainly in the mountains of Hawaii. And you can see that from 1958 to the present day, it has increased. And in fact, that curve gets slightly more steeply as we go on. So it's not only increasing, but accelerating. Until you see just the last two or three years, look, it's just leveled off a little bit for the first time since 1958. And that, I think, is due to the worldwide recession, the dash for gas, and the collapse of industry, of course, in the former Soviet bloc. So that we, for the first time, we're seeing it slightly leveled off. It's 356 parts per million by volume now, and in 1860 it was 275. So, as I say, of course, if that continues over the next 50 years or so, we should somewhere near like double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The second most important greenhouse gas, apart from water vapor, which is always there, is methane, and you can see methane also has increased in a rather similar way. You might wonder why you have this rather nice sinusoidal oscillations. There's an annual cycle there, and I think there must be a lot of biologists in the audience, and you know, that's because the trees are breathing. That's mainly in the northern hemisphere, in these, when the trees are growing, they're taking up, or vegetation is growing, they take up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, so it's a minimum in the summer and a maximum in the winter, so that shows up really rather nicely. You can see the trees breathing in that record. Now, of course, if we're going to predict what's going to happen in the future, we will need to know what the emissions of carbon dioxide and these other greenhouse gases are likely to be over the next 50 or 100 years, and that's almost anybody's guess. It'll depend very much on what governments decide about fuel policy, what mix of fuels they're going to have, whether we're going into nuclear in a large scale, or whether we're going to continue to burn fossil fuels and all the rest of it. So that's a very big uncertainty, and it's almost idle to speculate exactly what's going to happen very far in the future as far as the actual emissions are concerned. But even if we knew how much the emissions into the atmosphere of the gases were, we need to know what happens to those gases when they get into the atmosphere, because they don't all remain there. In fact, the amount of carbon dioxide that man puts into the atmosphere, which is about 5.5 billion tons a year, a billion is 1,000 million in the way I actually use it. Man puts in about 5.5 billion tons a year, but only about half of it remains in the atmosphere, just a slightly under half. We're not quite sure where all the rest goes to. In addition to the 5.5 that man puts in by burning fossil fuel and wood, the deforestation, cutting down the forests and cultivating the land, probably puts in about another billion tons a year. So around 6.6, something like that. Only 3.2 of that remains in the atmosphere. That we know because we can measure it very accurately. So that leaves 3.4. Much of that must go into the ocean. We know it's taken up by photosynthesis, by the plankton and so on in the ocean. But the best estimates of that are that it could take up about 2. So we've still got 1.4 billion tons that man-made activities go into the atmosphere each year that we can't account for. So that's there's a lot of research going on about that. Some people think that that more is taken up by trees and vegetation and regrowing forests and so on, and we think Some people think the soil takes it up, but I think that's all very doubtful, and the biological community studying this are very split about this. So the fact that we can't account for 1.4 out of 6.6 is a measure of our ignorance about exactly what happens to the carbon when you put it into the atmosphere. So that's another uncertainty. We overcome that as meteorologists by saying, well, we shall just assume that the carbon dioxide increases, doubles after a certain time, or it increases at some arbitrary rate, and we then put that into our climate models to calculate what will happen in the future. In other words, we can predict what will happen, but not quite when it will happen, because we don't know what the rates of the emissions are going to be in the future and exactly what happens to all the carbon dioxide. Now, I mentioned that water vapor was by far the most important of the greenhouse gases. I said that the outgoing infrared radiation from the Earth's surface is absorbed by the gases in the atmosphere, the greenhouse gases, of which water vapor is by far most important. And these gases radiate back to the Earth's surface 150 watts on every square meter. 100 of that comes from water vapor, and 50 from carbon dioxide. So water vapor is twice as important as a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. It's practically never mentioned in the press. But it has another important consequence. Because if by putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere you warm it, the warmer atmosphere will evaporate more moisture from the oceans and the surface of the Earth. So you increase the water vapor in the atmosphere. And therefore you get an amplification, because you're increasing the water vapor as well. And because water vapor is more powerful than carbon dioxide as an absorber, you get an amplification of this. So you have to consider what effect, not just of the greenhouse gases that man puts in, but what the effect on increasing the water vapor is. Now, if we go back and calculate or make an estimate of what man has done since the Industrial Revolution in putting in carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we actually can find out what the carbon dioxide was a very, very long time ago, long before we made daily measurements, by studying how much carbon dioxide is locked up in the little air bubbles in the ice sheets. You take a deep core out of an ice sheet, and you can trace how the ice has been laid down year by year back for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years. In fact, you can go back to the Ice Age, and from that you can extract the little bubbles, air bubbles entrapped in the ice, and measure the carbon dioxide, which was laid down all that time ago. And that's how we know that, say, in 1860, it was only 270 parts per million. And you can do the same for methane. And so you can actually calculate, or make a rough estimate, of how much greenhouse gases has been put into the atmosphere year by year since, say, whatever, like, let's say, we used to take 1860 as a sort of rather late part of the Industrial Revolution, 1760 if you want, before the Industrial Revolution. And if you calculate, if you do a simple calculation as to how much the greenhouse gases that man has put into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution, and then work out how much additional heating that would have produced, it's only about 2.4 watts per square meter from then until the present day. And if you work out simply how much that increase in temperature that would produce at the Earth's surface, it's about 1 degree. It's about 1 degree. So, on that basis, if we looked at the meteorological records, we should be able to see whether the actual surface temperature of the Earth has increased by something like 1 degree. Since that time. Well, the meteorological records, of course, aren't very good when you go that far back, but nevertheless, an enormous amount of work has been done in the Met Office and elsewhere to reconstruct the best historical record of temperatures since 1860 up to the present time, and these are, we're starting here, down here at 1860, and these are differences from the average. So this is minus 0.5 degree, minus 0.6 degree down here, and plus 0.4 here. So these are just the changes from the average. And you can see that there has been a gradual increase from then until the present day, 1994, you can see up here. And so that whole increase since 1860 to 1994 is about a half a degree. There's been about a half a degree warming. Whereas the simple calculation would tell you it perhaps ought to have been about 1 degree. Now, is that or is that not evidence that there is a greenhouse warming taking? Is that due to the greenhouse gases that man has put in? Or is it due just to natural fluctuations in the temperature of the Earth? And I think until very recently, I would have said almost certainly that this was natural fluctuations, because you can see the last decade, the last 10 years of the warmest on record, we've had about 0.3 degree rise since the 1980, you see, up to the present time. You can see there's a little falling off in the last couple of years, and that was due to the Pinatubo volcanic eruption in the Philippines. So you see how sensitive this is. But you'll also notice that there was an even bigger rise of about 0.4 of a degree from about 1910 until about 1950. So that when the emissions of the greenhouse gases were much less than they are today. So you get, you can't interpret that the rise we have in this record is simply due to the greenhouse gases. There's probably a lot of that is due to the natural variation. And in any case, we shall see that we would not expect to see a strong signal due to man-made greenhouse gases yet, because any effect it would have would be delayed by the oceans. The oceans take up half the carbon dioxide, or nearly half the carbon dioxide, but they also take up the heat. And the oceans have an enormous inertia, so they store this heat, as we shall see later on, and probably won't release it for another 20 or 30 years. So if there has been greenhouse warming due to man-made activities up to date, we shall not see the full signal of that for some time to come. But very recently, at the end of my lecture, I shall tell you, you may have seen something in the press about this, we've now discovered that the aerosols in the atmosphere, the pollution, tiny pollution particles in the atmosphere, cause a cooling of the atmosphere, and that also partly masks any greenhouse warming there might have well been. So nature is full of these twists and turns. It always is never quite straightforward. There are so many positive and negative feedbacks, some amplifying, some de-amplifying the system. And it's and all these various effects have to look back very carefully, and you have to look at the sum of these things. And that's what makes it so complicated, and that's why the story is changing quite fast at the present time, as I shall try and illustrate. Now, if we can't see evidence, strong evidence of warming due to man's activities in the meteorological records, and we may not be able to for a decade or so, what's all the fuss about? The reason is because the mathematical models, the computer models of climate, have predicted that there will be a change. So we're really, it's the computer models that have really alarmed, brought up the subject and alarmed people about it, starting with very simple models in the early 70s, and now some of the enormous computer models I'll be describing to you in a moment, the biggest computer models, probably scientific models in existence, and we shall see how their predictions have changed, and changed quite markedly over only the last 5 years or so. Now, if I were talking to you 4 or 5 years ago, I would have been describing to you the Meteorological Office model, which is one of the world leaders, one of the three leading world centers in this field, two in the States and Met Office. I would have been discussing their model that we're using then, that we developed in the 1980s, which was a model of the global atmosphere, coupled to a very shallow ocean. We didn't have the full deep ocean in the system for technical and computing reasons, but we had a shallow ocean, just an ocean which was 1 kilometer deep. Well, a lot of the physics goes on there, but on a long time scale, you have to worry about what happens in the deep ocean, and we didn't do that then. And the first thing you have to do with such a model is to see whether you can make it simulate the present climate as we see it, present-day climate of the Earth, how it varies from month to month, how it varies from season to season, whether it gets the wind systems of the world right, whether it gets the rainfall right, whether it gets the temperatures right, and so on. And if it's got to do that before you can ask this model what would happen if you make a small change by increasing carbon dioxide, for example, through man-made activities. Now, it is a fairly small change because there are 750 billion tons of carbon in the atmosphere, and man is putting in six or seven a year. So you see, it's a fairly small change. And if you doubled the amount of carbon dioxide in one go, if you did double it, the increased heating would be about 4 watts per square meter. Now that's 4 out of 150 from the natural greenhouse effect. So again, you're looking at something of a few percent. That's what we're trying to find out, what the response will be to changes of a few percent. So that model has got to be very good at predicting the present climate. If it doesn't get that right, it's no sense in arguing what we're asking, what will happen if you change things by only 2 or 3%. So the first thing you have to do is to build a model which, out of the basic equations of physics and mathematics, will actually create a climate for you on the computer, which is very similar to that we use. Of course, it's the same problem as weather forecasting. I mean, we use, in principle, we use very similar models for weather forecasting, where Bracknell, for example, predicts the weather for the whole of the globe every day for 7 days ahead. And in fact, we do the forecasting for New Zealand, and we can do it a lot better than they can do it, because we have much bigger computers and so on. And so that the models are similar in principle as weather forecasting models, but in weather forecasting you're concerned with what happens, say, a week or 10 days ahead, but if you're talking about climate, you're acting asking what the average change is going to be over decades or hundreds of years. So you have to bring in a lot of additional physics in if you're looking at these very long time scales, and you certainly have to bring in the oceans and the deep oceans as well. Now, I haven't got time to explain to you how we build these models, but perhaps I can just give you a flavour of the complexity. What we mean by a model is a set of mathematical equations which just express the laws of physics. We try and describe all the physical and dynamical processes and some chemical processes, for example, that go on in the atmosphere in terms of the mathematical equations. So we have Newton's laws of motion, we have the laws of thermodynamics, we have the transfer of heat by radiation, conduction and convection, for example, and we consider all the forces acting on the air that makes the air move. So we calculate the east-west component of the wind, the north-south component of the wind, the vertical component of the wind. When the wind blows, it evaporates moisture from the surface of the earth. It carries it up. The air expands and cools. The relative humidity of the air increases. It becomes saturated, and then the water vapor condenses and produces cloud. The clouds then, inside the cloud processes, the cloud droplets change and amalgamate to produce raindrops, or they freeze and go into ice crystals, and the ice crystals join together to produce snowflakes, and they fall out as rain or snow. And on the way down, then you have to calculate how much rain and snow there is, how much it evaporates or grows on the way down. When it gets to the Earth's surface, what's happened to the water? Well, you have to calculate how much runs off in the rivers and lakes, and how much flows out into the sea. How much is evaporated back again? How much is stored as ice? How much is stored in the soil? The soil moisture is terribly important for agriculture, so you've got to get the soil moisture out. And so you see, you have this enormous amount of physics going on. You have to worry about how the snow accumulates, how the ice cover spreads, how much the snow evaporates, how much it melts, and so on. Same with the sea ice, and so on. You even have to calculate how the sea ice drifts with the wind. In the model and things of that kind. It gives you just some idea. Now what we do in a model like that, we take the atmosphere, we take some sphere of course, and you divide the atmosphere into a number of concentric shells like an onion. There might be 10 or 20 of these levels between the ground and say 100,000 feet. And then on each of these levels you have a latitude-longitude grid, just as like you do on a map. And so we'd have several thousand points at each level, 20 levels. Like that, and you solve, calculate all these processes I've been talking about at each of these points every 20 minutes. You might take it up for 100 years. So let me just give you an idea of the sort of things we calculate. Now this, remember, is the old model. No deep ocean in this. But as far as the atmosphere is concerned, we had 7,000 points at each level, 100,000 points in all. And we could, and some, these are some of the things we would calculate every 20 minutes. The east, west, and north, south components of the wind. The vertical motion of the air, because that takes up and forms the clouds and the rain, so that's very important. The air temperature, the humidity of the air, the heights of the, how the, these various levels, how they change in light and pressure or in height. The incoming radiation from the sun, the long wave, infrared radiation from the ground, and how that's all absorbed by the clouds and the gases and all the rest of it. The amount of cloud, the height of the cloud, how much the cloud, liquid water the cloud contains, and how much ice, how much falls out as rain or snow, the change in atmospheric pressure at the Earth's surface, the land surface temperature, how that changes, the soil moisture, the snow cover, the extent and depth of the snow, the extent of the sea ice and its depth, how that changes, the ice surface temperature, and the sea surface temperature, for example. There are some of the key things, many other things as well, but there are some of the key things. And as I say, every 20 minutes, and on that model, that meant that a 24 hours just doing it for one day was one followed by 11 noughts, numerical steps, on the computer. And on the computer we had in those days, the Cray-YMP, it took about one whole year, it took about 10 hours of calculation to do it every 20 minutes for a whole year, so you go through the whole year cycle. Well, as you see, we do much better than that now. But I'm just going to show you, just a few slides, to show you what the effect with that model of doubling the carbon dioxide. But before I do that, let me just, I did say that it's terribly important that such a model would in fact simulate the present climate properly. Now, it doesn't do it absolutely perfectly, but, and these are, it's very, this is rather a small scale map, but what I wanted to show you was that this is the, this is for an average in the summer of June, July and August. How the average surface pressure patterns of the Earth's surface change. That's what we get from the daily weather observations. You can see the you can see the highs and lows. Here's the Azores anticyclone. Here's the Pacific anticyclone. Here's this string of anticyclone down in the southern hemisphere. And here's the low pressure areas over the land. You see. And this is what we had with when we had a much cruder model here at the top. Can you see that? Yeah. That's against the top, and that was with the model as we left it at the end of the 1980s. And you can see that there's very good agreement. Just you can see very good agreement between those two. There are some small systematic errors, but by and large, it simulates the actual pressure. And if you want to look at the temperatures, which perhaps is a little easier to see. The top is the computer model, and the bottom is what you get from the observations. And I think you'll agree that that's, it's not perfect. You see the computer model gets slightly too cold over Greenland, for example. That blue up there is a little too cold. But by and large, it's pretty good. So that gives us confidence that if we can actually produce the world's climate on a computer, and we don't actually need any observations to do that, we can actually stop from the beginning. We start with an atmosphere which is utterly at rest. There's no winds. It's the same temperature everywhere, so it's isothermal. It's completely dry. There's no water vapor in the atmosphere. There aren't any clouds. And we tell the computer that. We tell it the distribution of land and sea in the mountains, and we say to the computer, switch on the sun now. So we switch on the sun at this particular instant of time, and then let the thing, the computer generate its own climate. And you'll see what will happen if you switch on the sun. You create a temperature difference between the pole and the equator. If you do that, you then change and set up a pressure difference between the pole and the equator. You set up a pressure difference that makes the air move, so the winds start to blow. And when the winds start to blow, they start to evaporate moisture from the surface of the earth, and it's carried up and it starts to produce the clouds and the rain and so on. And the whole thing, then about a year on the computer, will generate a climate just like I've been showing from scratch. So for this you don't actually need any observations. You can start from Genesis, if you like, right from the beginning. Isn't that remarkable? You can actually do that just from the mathematical equations of physics, that you can create world time without actually putting any observations in. Can't do that for weather forecast. Well, now, when you do that, you can then say to it, well, now, what will happen, for example, if I double the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere? And in the early experiments, again, because we had a shallow ocean, we doubled the carbon dioxide in one go. We doubled the carbon dioxide and then allowed the computer climate to adjust itself to come into equilibrium with double the carbon dioxide. And I have the slides now, those four slides, please. I'll show you now what that model said would happen if you doubled the carbon dioxide to the temperatures and the rainfall. Now, this map is for the changes in temperature which you would get if you doubled the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for the months of December, January, and February, in other words, winter in the Northern Hemisphere. And the colours go from, this is from 0 to 2 degrees, and this is, the purple here is more than 12 degrees centigrade. And you can see that's pretty alarming because there isn't much change in the tropics and subtropics and the equator. But as you go towards the North Pole, as you go towards the Arctic, you get these very, very high temperature increases, 10 or 12 degrees. And so that was pretty alarming. And if you... Next one shows you for June, July and August, when it's winter in the Southern Hemisphere. And we get a rather similar map, but the other way around. That's it. Now you see all the warming is down in the Antarctic. Again, not very much in the tropics. And you'll see that these areas of warming here. The temperature is not uniform, even across a latitude band. If you do that for the whole year on that model, average for the whole year, and over all latitudes, and take the average over the whole Earth, it would have been 5.2 degrees centigrade. You can just remember 5.2. And the rainfall, could I have the next slide, please? The rainfall, this shows December, January, and February, the changes in the rainfall. The browns and oranges are areas of decrease. And the blues are areas of increase. And the first thing you see how patchy it is. There are some areas of increase, some of decrease. The areas of major increase are here in the tropics and subtropics. There's some drying out actually in Eurasia and parts of the prairies and so on. The next slide, please, shows the same pattern in June, July, and August. Perhaps that's it.
It's working at the
moment. Can we go back? I better put my glasses on. I can still see. Is that still June, July? Yes. Could we have the one before, please? One before, yes. But again, you see how patchy it is in June, July, and August. The increases are done. Well, you could see from June, July, and August, there were increases in Southeast Asia and in the monsoon areas. And again, in the tropical... Oh, that's it. That's December, January, and February. And you can see the increases down here. And some decreases. And then if we just have another look at the other one then, please. June, July, August. And then you've got the increases here in Southeast Asia, the monsoon area, and again across here in the subtropics, and some small decreases across much of Eurasia. If you took over the whole year and averaged it over all seasons and so on, the globe as a whole, the increase in rainfall would have been 15%. So we had 5.2 degrees rise in temperature and 15% increase in the rainfall. And that's the story would have been, say, 5 years ago. It took rather a long. We understand why there would be this increase in the high latitudes, in the polar regions. They're very good reasons. We understand physically why that should be the case. But, of course, we realised this model wasn't perfect. We only had a shallow ocean, so the deep ocean wasn't involved, and the deep ocean must play an important part in the long run. Secondly, The other thing that we knew very well was that we weren't treating the clouds properly in this model. The clouds have a profound impact on the radiation, both coming in from the sun. It scatters the clouds scatter back the incoming solar radiation from the sun to space. They also absorb some of the infrared radiation from the ground. And so the clouds play an enormously important part in regulating the heat balance of the atmosphere. In this early model, we did not ask the model to predict its own cloud. There are lots of technical reasons, partly because you need a lot more computing power than there even was at that time. So we actually told it what the clouds were. We have satellite observations from the clouds, of course, across the world every day. So we actually told the model what the clouds were and imposed these sort of observed clouds on the model. Well, that's a dangerous thing to do because you don't necessarily get the two things into synchronization, and the model didn't like that terribly well, and we knew that wasn't the right thing to do. And we knew we'd have to put in a big effort into actually making the model predict its own cloud. And as you heard, I was a professor of cloud physics, the first and last in the world. One was enough, I think, probably. So I had a very great interest in getting the clouds right in this model. So then the first thing we did was to make the model predict the cloud in terms of the vertical motion of the air and the relative humidity and how much of the water condensed out. And the first step was to do it and leave it all as liquid water. That reduced the warming from 5.2 degrees to 3.2. The next step was to, the higher, colder clouds gradually transform into ice. And the ice crystals affect the radiation very differently from the water drops. So we then calculated this gradual transformation of the water drop into ice crystals and the ice crystals joining together from snowflakes and so on. And that reduced it from 3.2 to 2.6. And then we allowed the ice crystals to fall out, and we took a much greater account of the shape of the ice crystals and so on, and how they affect the radiation. And that reduced it down to about 2.3 degrees. So just by changing the cloud alone, the global warming had come down from 5.2 to 2.3. The next step then was to do something about building a really complicated model of the whole deep ocean, and then couple that to the atmospheric model. For that we had to wait the next generation of computers, and we had to put a big effort. It takes years to build one of these models for a big team. I mean, the center at Bratton has 80 scientists working full time on this climate problem. So we built a complex model of the oceans and coupled that to the atmosphere. Now, we could then get away from this business of doubling the carbon dioxide in one go. I mean, that wasn't a very realistic thing to do. So we decided we would let the CO2 increase gradually at 1% per annum compound, which means it doubles after 70 years, and do it very gradually, rather like it does in nature. But if you're going to run the model and allow this to happen over 70 years, you can't ignore the deep ocean. The deep ocean is going to have something to say about what happens to that heat and that carbon dioxide over 70 years. So we had to wait till we had to couple the model in order to do this experiment. Well, that's been done. So we had a model with 17 layers in the ocean, and now we calculate the ocean currents, we calculate the changes in salinity, we calculate the temperature changes in the ocean, and so on. And then let the CO2 double gradually after 70 years. And this map shows the average change in surface temperature at the 70th year when the CO2 carbon dioxide has doubled. And now you see there's a big difference between that map and the other ones I showed you. There are no reds and purples on this. The warming is very, very much less. You can see that the biggest changes are 4 degrees up here in the Arctic. There's practically no warming in the Antarctic. There's practically no warming in the Southern Hemisphere oceans. It's practically all in the Northern Hemisphere. And that was mainly the effect of having a deep ocean in the model. The average temperature change in that at the 70th year is now 1.7 degrees. So we come back to 5.2 to 1.7. And if you'd like to see how that goes year to year over the 70 years, almost 70 years. Now you see that the average for the globe, which is the green line, 0.2 is very good. But you can, the green line, you see, and it, you see how much variation there is from year to year. Each of these triangles is 1 year. And that's 1.7 degrees after 70 years.
But what's pleasing about this is, it is not a straight line. You've got the year-to-year variation in the model. And that's terribly important because the natural climate varies from season to season, from year to year. And the model, if it's any good, must not just ordinary, to predict or simulate the average values. We must get the natural variability of the climate as well. And what's so nice about that, that's very, very similar to the natural variability. But the general trend is upwards, and you've got your 1.7 degrees. Now you can see that, look for that, the blue line is the northern hemisphere, and the red line is the southern hemisphere. And you can see most of it's in the northern hemisphere, as you saw from the last map. And the reason is because the deep ocean in the southern hemisphere takes a lot of the heat down to depth and keeps it there. So if you now look at the ocean, what happens in the ocean, this is the ocean. I think I'll use my own laser, which might be a bit more powerful. The background is sort of like, here's the surface of the ocean going from North Pole to South Pole, the equator's here, and then this is a vertical slice from the top of the ocean right down to the bottom of the ocean. And this just shows the changes in temperature you get when the carbon dioxide has doubled at the end of the seventh year. And you see that there are changes here of only about 1 degree, the maximum change is about... and stopping the surface temperature rising more than about a degree or so. And there's even a little bit in the Atlantic, this is the Northeast Atlantic here. It doesn't go down as far, only about 1.5 kilometres down, but some of it is taken down even in... So the oceans now are playing a very important part. They absorb a good deal of the heat, they carry it down to great depths where it will be stored for 20 or 30 years before it comes out again. And so the oceans not only reduce the heating, they delay it. That heat will come out eventually, but it might be 20, 30 years before it does. So, so now we're down to 1.7 degrees. It's the best estimate at the moment of what the average global warming would be if you increase the carbon dioxide at 1% per annum compound interest after 70 years when it's doubled. Well, that isn't quite the end of the story, because in the last few weeks we'll have some other things to worry about. But let me just summarize by telling you that what's happened to models elsewhere. The American model, which also now has a deep ocean in it, it says 2.3 degrees. In Hamburg, they just got their first run with their coupled model, and they have 1.3. They're the lowest at the moment, and we're right in the middle at 1.7. So it's somewhere in that range, 1.3 to 2.3, as the best estimates at the moment for the carbon dioxide rise. Now, what effect would that have on sea level? You've all read these scare stories about melting the Antarctic ice and the sea level rising 15 feet. It's a lot of rubbish, of course. You can't melt the Antarctic ice. I mean, if you melt the sea ice, of course, it doesn't make any difference. If you melt all the sea ice, it doesn't change, as you know, by putting ice cubes in your cocktail or glass. It has to be land-based ice to make any difference. And there's so much of it, and it's so cold down there, that you can't really make very much impression on the Antarctic ice. Now, the best estimates are that over the last 100 years, the sea level has risen about 10.5 centimetres. And 4 of that centimetres come from just the expansion of the oceans. The oceans get warmer, the water just expands. There's a little bit from the melting of the glaciers, land glaciers, which we all know about, the recession of the glaciers in Europe and Switzerland and so on. And the melting of the Greenland ice cap, a little bit of that, about 2.5. So over the last 100 years, about 10.5. Now what will happen if you double the carbon dioxide over 70 years, according to our model? Then it says that the oceans will expand about 2 centimeters per decade of 10 years, melting glaciers 1,
Greenland about one, you get 4 centimeters per decade, and you'll get nothing from the Antarctic. In fact, of course, you increase the snowfall of the Antarctic, it probably goes the other way. So the Antarctic, instead of melting and giving you a rise in sea level, goes the opposite. The sea level would drop if the snow increased in the Antarctic. So anyway, that gives you about 4 centimeters per decade, 4 centimeters per 10 years. So over the 70 years, you might think something like 28 centimeters, which, you know, I mean, that's about a foot, so that, but it's different from 15 feet. And we're talking about 70 years ahead, and I'm not saying that's negligible. In the low-lying areas like Bangladesh and so on, and the low-lying Pacific Islands and so on, that would be substantial, but it's not anything like the catastrophe some people were talking about a few years ago. Well, now finally, the largest part in the story is to realizing that because during the El Shishon volcanic eruption, in what was that, 86 or something like that, and the Pinatubo in 1992, we have been able from satellites to actually measure the amount of radiation which is cut off from the sun by the volcanic eruption. Now most of that, the stuff, it goes in the lower atmosphere, it doesn't matter very much because it's washed out by the rain within a week. So to have any effect on the climate, it's got to get right up into the stratosphere where it stays for couple of years or so. And we realized from these two explosions we could actually measure the amount of radiation cut off by the sun. I don't know whether I've actually brought... Yes, I have. This shows you the amount of radiation which is transmitted through the atmosphere. You see, it was roughly about 94%, not between 92 and 94%, and then you have El Shishon in 1983, I think it was, and it was down to about 78%. And this is Pinatubo, not quite as big, but down to about 82%. So there's no doubt that the dust up in the stratosphere there, put in by the volcano, which is mainly sulfate aerosols, as a matter of fact, the sulfuric acid, scatter back the sun's radiation and stop it getting down to warm the atmosphere. So we then had to start to worry about whether we could actually put into the model the effect of these aerosols, because they would have a cooling effect and partly offset any warming that we would get due to the greenhouse gases. And so that's what's just been done. This work hasn't been published yet, as a matter of fact. So this is all really very new. And the first thing that the Met Office did, which I was very pleased about, they first of all started the model back in 1860, taking the observations such as they were in those days, and running it without any increase in man-made carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases or any aerosols due to atmospheric pollution, whether it was man-made or whether it was volcanic. And you see they got a good deal of failure. You run it forward to 1990, and you can see year by year the temperature here varies, as it should do, from year to year. But there's no overall increase. This line, if you took the average around there, is practically no trend. There's no increase. Then they went back to 1860 and increased the man-made carbon dioxide and the greenhouse gases year by year, the best they could estimate, and run the model again. And you see, this is this line here, the blue line. And you can see by 1990, there was about 1 degree rise in temperature, which the model said would have been produced cumulatively by all the greenhouse gases and so on which were put in since the Industrial Revolution. I showed you that the actual temperature only rose 0.5 degree. And I showed you the actual observations at 0.5 degree. So, there's something very interesting. The model says 1 degree, the observations say 0.5 degree. And that was an indication that the aerosols were probably making a difference. So they've now run the model again with the aerosols in, and that's closed that gap. The actual rise is 0.5 degree if you put the aerosols in. These are the aerosols not just due to volcanoes, because you don't get them very often. These are just due to man-made industrial output and power stations and all the rest of it, mainly sulfate aerosols which produce the acid rain and so on, which is another story. And to show that, they've actually put this into a model, the global model, and they've actually, in order to show it up, because it's a fairly small change, they have actually made the pollution twice as big as it actually is. And this curve, this map of the world, shows the effect due to the aerosol. And these blue areas here are areas of cooling. And in that it means that the aerosols have overwhelmed any global warming there might be up to the present time. And these areas of cooling, the blue areas of cooling, you see where they are. They're either over or downwind of the big industrial areas in the world. Eastern United States, Western Europe, China and Southern Asia. And so up till now, probably, one of the reasons we haven't seen a greenhouse warming in the meteorological records is because it's being largely offset by the aerosols, man has put in as well. Now you have a dilemma. We want to get rid of the aerosols because of acid rain and asthma and all the other things, the health effects and so on. But of course, if we do that, then the greenhouse warming will be rather more serious. I haven't got that, so that's a problem that will have to be sorted out. Anyway, that's the latest story, ladies and gentlemen, about what of the modelling of the climate and the various things that we're taking into account. You see that over the years, what's happened is as we've improved the models, improved their physics, and so on, that the threat from greenhouse gases has steadily come down from 5.2 to a bit over 1 degree. And if you take the aerosols in, probably a bit less than that. Now, we have to be a bit careful about that. I mean, clearly the thing is not as alarming as it appeared 5 years ago. But the models are not perfect. There are still new things that we know we can improve. And it may be that we go on that so far everything we've done is reduce the threat. We can't necessarily assume that's going to continue to happen because we're dealing with an extremely complex system, highly non-linear. So you have to be, we may have some surprises. There may be some things that we haven't taken into account yet, which would increase the apparent threat. But what I think I can say at the present time that the state of our understanding and of our ability to model, the picture has been changing quite rapidly. And therefore, we are some way off, I think, because the model story is changing rather rapidly, of being very confident about giving governments advice that they should do something drastic at the present time. If it was going to be 5 degrees or more, then I think governments would be right, perhaps, to think about some very drastic changes in energy policy and all the rest of it. But if we're down to about about a degree in 50 years' time, we can live with that, I suspect. We can certainly adapt to it. There are many things that we can do. We don't have to do nothing at all. But I think at the present state that it wouldn't be, there's no scientific basis for telling governments they've got to do something really radical. You know, about disrupting industry, going up, you know, nuclear in a very large scale, changing vast expenditure on sea defences, moving populations and all that sort of thing. But that doesn't mean that we should do nothing at all. And I think in the next 10 or 20 years, we must do two things. We must put a big emphasis still on improving the models and increasing our scientific understanding of what goes on. We must get good observations from around the world, both from the atmosphere, from the oceans, and to see what's going on, so that we can detect greenhouse warming when it appears above the natural variability. To do that, we need observations from the oceans. Now, we don't have observations from the ocean. Only the satellites can do marvelous things at looking at the ocean surface. They can measure the temperature within a tenth of a degree. They can measure the height of the sea surface temperature 800 kilometers up within a few centimeters. They can measure the wave height. We can actually get the wind speed at the surface. But the satellites can't see into the deep ocean. And if we're going to do that, make observations on the same way as we do in the atmosphere, then we've got to think about automatic small submarines, unmanned submarines going off the ocean, computer controlled, all the rest of it. And that'd be very, very expensive to get the observations from the ocean. But we've got to get better observations, we've got to do better science over the next 10 or 20 years, and we've got, I think, to think how we can adapt ourselves to climate change. If it will come at some time, it won't be perhaps as drastic as we thought a few years ago, but we can do a lot of things to adapt to it. These days of genetic engineering, what you can do to make agriculture, energy, transport, water supply, all these things which are climate sensitive, you can make them more resilient and more robust against climate change. And it's not just natural climate change, a man-made climate change you need to worry about. At the moment, you get much more disaster from natural climate changes, the big storms, the hurricanes, and all the rest of it. And we've got to be able to understand and predict those. So even if there was no man-made threat at all, even if this whole thing just sort of bubble burst, we would still need to carry on with our understanding of the climate for predicting natural climate disasters, which at the moment, they say, do more damage than perhaps man-made, although, of course, to some extent, Erling. So that is how I see it, and I suppose, in a way, the politicians are in a very difficult situation. The British government and several of the Western powers have already decided at Rio, that's about the only thing they did decide, that they would try and reduce the carbon dioxide emissions in the year 2000 back to what they were in 1990. They've gone up a bit in the meantime. Well, that wasn't a very big deal. And we could do that in the UK because we've jolly well already met that 2000-year target with the dash for gas, increased nuclear, some of the old heavy industries disappearing and so on. And that goes for most of Western Europe. So I don't think I had any difficulty in agreeing at Berlin that the Western world, at any rate, would hold by the year 2000, bring back the emissions to what they were in 1990. That's no great big deal. What do they do beyond the year 2000? Of course, they can agree on that. And in any case, and the Americans don't want the imposition, the OPEC countries were dead against it. They just want to go on selling their oil. Well, you thought that had enough sense to put up the price like they did before and keep it in the ground. But, of course, the real problem is the world population problem. If the world population is going to double in the next 50 years, is inevitable, there is no way that they're going to be able to reduce overall the global emissions of carbon dioxide. Most of that's going to come from the developing world, from China, from India, the Pacific Rim, Mexico, places like that. And whatever we do in the West, it will be determined by very largely what they do. And they're going to go ahead, they're going to industrialize, they're going to burn coal and fossil fuels because they've got that kind of thing else. And so what we do, in a sense, I don't think is going to determine what happens at the end of the day. It's those countries which will decide. And unless we can do something to restrict the population problem, then the greenhouse warming and climate change, it'll be at some stage, it may be towards the end of the next century or beyond, we shall have a problem, a bigger problem than I talked about tonight. But by that time, perhaps we shall have a much deeper understanding of what produces these climate changes and a rather more intelligent attitude to what we can do to mitigate them or to adapt to them. Thank you very much. Well, they may well have had. What we've done in the modelling, we have actually cut down the whole of the Amazon rainforest in the modelling. That's a fairly easy thing to do in the computer. And there's no question, if you remove the whole of the Amazon rainforest, it reduces the rainfall and the evaporation by about 10 or 15% over the whole area. And that's over the area itself. But of course, the effects are spread more widely. They decrease, of course, as you go away. But you can actually see the effects of, say, 10 and 5% spread over pretty well the whole of South America and all that belt. So there's no doubt if you do things on a large enough scale. Of course, with local climate is concerned, on a local scale, then you would really have to examine what happens in detail. Of course, it could be affected by deforestation. It could be, you'd have to think about the local airflow over the mountains, of course, which very much control the rainfall, you know. You'd really have to do a detailed local study. And of course, in this climate modelling business, I've given you a very coarse view. We've been talking about things on a global scale, averaged over global. Now, nobody in effect wants to know what happens on the average over the globe as a whole. You want to know what happens in regional and sub-regional and much smaller areas, what's going to happen in Western Europe and the UK. Now, the models agree quite well, the different models agree reasonably well on the major changes in the rainfall, temperatures, winds and so on a global scale. But when you get down to a smaller scale, continental, subcontinental, regional scales, they differ much more. That's not surprising. Because although we have 300,000 points in the model, they're still 250 kilometres by 375 kilometres apart. And so they, you know, and if you want to bring that down, say, to 100 kilometres by 100 kilometres, for example, which is what they're hoping to do, then you need a computer which, that's 10, that's 2 by 2 by 2, that's 8, that's 16 times as much computing. Now, the model that we're using that I've just told you, the latest version of the model with the deep ocean, for 1 year is 2 followed by 14 noughts, arithmetical calculations on the computer. With a new computer that we've just got at the Met Office, it has 16 central processors, each which will do 1 billion calculations per second. And so if you use the whole 16 processors all of the time, to run that model for a year takes 3 hours. Now you don't get the whole 16 because you have to use them for weather forecasting and things as well. But that's the size of the computing task. Now if you want to bring it down and look at things, and in the oceans of course, it's the model is far too coarse in the oceans, because in the oceans you have weather systems, you have fronts and you have the equivalent of depressions and so on. But they're only 1/10 the size, the weather systems in the ocean, they are in the atmosphere. So you really ought to have a computing grid only 1/10 the size, and then you're talking about 1,000 times it's as much computing to get the same resolution, the same detail in the oceans as you do in the atmosphere. And so there's almost no limit to the sort of amount of computing power that you need. And so the models at this time cannot really say anything about your problem of what would happen on that sort of local scale. I mean, the Met Office is under great pressure from the politicians to say, you know, what's going to happen to the UK off that. Now, that's a daft thing to ask for. If I'd been Director General, I'd have been told that. I certainly wouldn't even try to do it, because I think it's stretching the models far beyond what they're capable of doing. But, of course, in the last analysis, that's what we want to know. We want to know what's going to happen to the soil moisture for agriculture, what's going to happen to sea level rise, what's going to happen to temperature, wind, and so on quite a small scale. And they've got a long, long way before we're going to be able to do that. If we're talking about it's a hard job to do it for more than 10 days of a week ahead for weather forecasting, but you're going to do it for climate decades or 100 years apart. That's a long time off before we're going to be able to do that. But I suppose computing power is amazing, how much speed has increased over the years, and how it's always the same number of dollars. Whenever you buy a supercomputer, the next generation, it's always the same number of computer dollars. It's been ever since I've been in the game. It's always been about £15 million. And you get 10 years, get 10 times more computing power each few years, you see. So if it goes on like that, well, maybe we'll get around to it. But we can't really say from these models what's going to happen on a local scale, as you're asking, as important as those questions are.
Thank you.
Do you emphasize that the uncertainty, the fact that the models are going to have, but then towards the end of the talk, you seem to use...
Well, not to a point. You see, you can carry this too far. It always has to be a balance. All these things have a cost, and always you have to make a balance between the cost and the benefits. And the economists all over the place in trying to work these things out. It's not easy, of course, to do these cost-benefit studies. I've looked into these and done some myself. I think if we're talking about what's going to happen over the next, what we should do over the next 10 years, I'm sure the balance lies with putting the money into the science and into the observations. if we can't observe what goes on in the atmosphere and the oceans, then we don't know what we're talking about. We haven't got the input to the models, we haven't got observations to test the predictions of the models, and, you know, we've got no basis for any kind of policy unless we have those observations. So I think, now, we've got a little time, you see, we're talking about maybe 1.5-2 degrees towards the middle or the end of next century. So we have a little time. We don't have infinite time, but we do have. What do we do over the next 10 or 20 years? I think because the situation is changing quite rapidly, has changed quite rapidly over the last time, we should look pretty foolish if we'd have worked on the basis of 5.2 degrees, for example, 5 years ago. If you're going to make very major changes in energy policy, for example, switch from fossil fuels to nuclear in a big way, which is what the alternative would be, because, you know, when we talk about renewables, renewables are fine, but they're only going to make any really difference, only if it can make a few percent difference, whatever you do. That would be a tremendous change. There'd be tremendous opposition to nuclear in any case. And so, you see, I think that that has to be a political decision, basically. If you're asking me as a scientist, what all I'm prepared to do is to tell the politicians what our best scientific judgment really is on the science of what we understand and what the uncertainties are. It's largely up to the policymakers and the politicians and so on to decide what they actually do about it. It's not for me to tell them what to do, but I just give you my personal view that I think over the next few years we should take that to try and improve the models, to try and hope that we get greater convergence between the various models, because although they're different and they have all sorts of differences between them, the basic laws of physics that are the same of all them, and if we get the physics right, they should tell the same story. So we might hope, and that's already happening, that the predictions of the different models are converging. And if they converge, you know, almost on the same point, we'll have a lot more confidence. And there's several other groups now, there are about 10 or 20 groups starting up climate modelling around the world, so there'll be much more activity. If we can get more convergence of results from the models, we have more confidence in them as to what we think will happen. That leads out the time scale as when it will happen, because as I said, that depends on what we do about the fuel policy and what we do about lots of other things. That's where my priorities are. I don't think it's absolutely urgent to, you know, turn up energy policy upside down or agricultural policy. I mean, I've heard people say that, you know, with global warming, you can't grow potatoes in England anymore. I've heard that. Well, I heard one of the leading fellow of the Royal Society actually tell that to Mrs. Thatcher when I was there, you see, and I've forgotten. I was with the Prime Minister and I said, for God's sake, I said, you know, they grow potatoes in Egypt and Cyprus, we import them. So if they can grow them there, why can't we? Maybe it's not King Edward's, or maybe I don't know. I mean, you get that sort of statement, which doesn't do any good at all. But you could make agriculture very much more resilient. I mean, with genetic engineering and crop breeding and so on, you can make more drought resistant, more frost resistant and so on. The countries which have cash crop agriculture, if they diversify their agriculture, they'd be much less vulnerable to it. And that's the line the United States took. Before the Rio conference, in the Bush administration, they were going to Rio and said, we don't care. I had a study by the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering, and they said, we don't care. If it rises 3 degrees, we can cope in the States. Our agriculture is very rich and diversified. We've got the best technology in the world. We can live with it, and we don't care. It's somebody else's problem. And they were going to take an extremely negative view of doing nothing. And then Al Gore came in, who, as you know, has written a book on carbon dioxide. Not a very good book, I must say. And that changed. It changed the American attitude to Rio to some extent. But they've taken a pretty hard line about having any quotas and so on at the Berlin meeting. And I think that's going too far. I'm not saying we should do nothing at all. Yes, there are things we can do on the precautionary principle. Of course we should do energy conservation, we should save energy, do all the sensible things. And there are much more. I could give you a lecture on what you could do about sea defences, building these on an incremental basis as the threat develops, if you design them right from at the beginning. There are lots of actual things you can do make us less vulnerable. And so adaptation is, I think, a very important factor, which has really not been taken terribly seriously at the moment. So, you know, I'm with you up at the precautionary principle to a level, but there is a penalty beyond which we probably couldn't afford to do it without a very major drop in standard of living. And anyway, the Chinese weren't taking notice of that. Remember, there are 1.3 billion of them.
Can I ask two questions? First of all, do you have anything to say about ice ages on a large scale?
Yes.
And can I just ask also, do you have anything to say about methane, which is supposed to be more of a greenhouse gas than CO2, and might, if it's mined from the sea bottom, might be more important?
Yes, well, let me take the first one thing. Yes, molecule for molecule, of course, methane is more important, and is about 25. Molecule for molecule, methane absorbs the infrared 25 times as effective as carbon dioxide. And the CFCs in the aerosol cans is about 10,000 to 1. But of course, they're there in very much smaller concentrations. CFC gases, they're in parts per trillion. CO2 is in hundreds of parts per million. So there's a difference. But methane is the second most important. It probably, if CO2 is, say, 60%, methane is about 15. So the methane is significant. Methane's increasing slowly. If there was a major climate change and the permafrost started to melt, for example, then a lot of methane would come out of the soil. So most of it, I think, the increase at the moment is due to leakage from gas pipelines in the Soviet Union and places like that. Get quite a lot from belching animals and things of that kind. We have to watch the methane. I think we have to watch the methane. That's going up, as you saw, as rapidly as CO2. The big ice ages, we're talking about the things for every 100,000 years or so, where the temperature fell, you know, in a depth of an ice age by 5-6 degrees centigrade. Now, that's a different kettle of fish. Now, they are triggered by things external to the Earth's climate system. And they are triggered by the fact of the variation of the orbit of the Earth around the Sun. There are three components. There's one is the actual eccentricity of the shape of the ellipse. And there's the inclination of the axis of the Earth to the ecliptic. And there's another one due to the precession of the perihelion. One has a 100,000-year cycle, one has 40,000, and one has 20,000-year cycle. And actually, you can detect that from the climate changes. If you look at the deep ocean cores or the deep ice cores, you can actually detect the 100,000-year cycle, 40,000-year cycle, 20,000. And I put that into an elementary climate model. I was the first to put it in a climate model. It's 1976, so-called Milankovitch effect, and did some much more simple calculations without a computer, and satisfied myself that this triggered the big ice ages. They needed a bit of help from changes in the ocean circulation and changes in CO2, but I think everybody's agreed now that the major big changes in the real ice ages are changed by not the output of energy from the sun, but the change in the geometry, so the amount of energy that falls on the Earth's atmosphere theories.
But that's not a controversial point, is it?
That's really not controversial now. I think more and more evidence is coming for that every day from the paleoclimatologists who've done a marvellous job on that.
Yes,
Temple,
I'm sorry.
Assuming the methane
is
yes,
very much so. Well, of course, the models predict the surface currents. I mean, that's one of in the ocean model, we have many of the levels very close to the surface. I mean, there are 20 levels in the ocean, but about six of them are very close together in the surface layer to get the surface currents, and really rather accurately. Yes, of course they do, and of course the El Nino, for example, is an extremely good example of that. That changes, as you know, the depth of the mixed layer, the top layer of the ocean, and suppresses the upwelling currents which bring the nutrients up for the fish. That's why the fish stocks die during the El Nino. Now, up till now, I have to say, the models haven't been very brilliant at predicting or simulating the El Nino. And that's largely because the resolution, the spacing of the grid in the ocean is too coarse. And it doesn't get things like the Gulf Stream and the Kuroshio, you know, the currents that really matter from the point, particularly from the ocean biology. They're rather narrow currents, and the models don't resolve those terribly well on this coarse scale that I've been talking about. And so we're now developing a model, I shouldn't say we anymore, because I'm no longer in the Met Office, but you can see I keep tabs on what's going on.
going for a thing which is only about 50 kilometres or 50 kilo by 50 kilometres. And that's that model takes care of the areas where the narrow currents are and off the coastlines of the continent. So you've got the Japanese, Kuroshio, and you've got the and they embed this fine mesh model into the big one, because you don't have enough computing power to put it everywhere. And so they're now beginning to get these surface currents and these narrow currents and these areas of upwelling which bring the nutrients up and so on, get these really rather better, and that's one of the things they're putting quite a lot of effort into. And I shall be very much happier when they really produce in El Nino and things like that rather more realistically than they do at the moment, but I think that'll come within a year or two. You need another hour's lecture on that. There again is a very interesting side story on that. The CFCs together contribute, if you take them from the time they started, right off the present, contribute about 12%, 12-15% compared to 66% from CO2. So up till now, they've been a significant, small but significant contribution as a greenhouse gas. Very powerful, molecule for molecule, as I said, although the concentrations are really very small. Now, but ozone is also a greenhouse gas. So if you abolish the CFCs, and that's what's happened, as you know, that's one thing that has stuck the Montreal Agreement, so the CFCs are coming down a little bit, the concentration in the atmosphere are coming down. You might think that if you abolish those and get rid of them as a greenhouse gas, that would help the greenhouse problem. But of course it doesn't, because if you reduce the CFCs, which attack the ozone, you increase the ozone. And the ozone's a greenhouse gas. And if you work it out, these two things practically cancel out. So you get no benefit from abolishing CFCs as far as the greenhouse gas, greenhouse warming is concerned. Of course, destroying the ozone in the stratosphere and the ozone hole is another problem. And I think there's now very little doubt that the ozone hole and the depletion of ozone in the stratosphere is largely due to the CFCs. I mean, we can measure these now from satellite. The concentration is very accurate indeed. And although there's still a lot of controversy exactly about what mechanisms produce the ozone hole, because the chemistry is very, very complicated. When I was a student, there were only three chemical reactions involved in ozone in the stratosphere. There are now at least 200 going on simultaneously, some which are relatively trivial and some are very complicated. But a lot of that chemistry over the Antarctic in the wintertime to produce the ozone hole, the chemistry doesn't take place in the gaseous phase. It's absorbed on the ice crystals in the very high stratospheric polar clouds, which only occur in the dark winter night. At very high levels, and the chemistry takes place on the surface of these ice particles. And that's a very devil of a job to study in the laboratory as to how that chemistry goes on. But if you don't, no model will predict the ozone hole unless you have something like that included. The fact is you don't get these clouds very much in the Arctic, so that's why you don't get an ozone hole in the Arctic, but you get it in the Antarctic. So there's enormous activity going on the stratospheric chemistry of ozone. They'll say it would take another whole lecture. You have to invite me again if you want me to talk about that. But it's linked to some extent to the global warming, but as I said, you don't get the benefit from global warming by getting rid of the CFCs, because it just increases the ozone. And so the atmosphere, you see how clever it is. It's always, something happens and it's got mechanisms which try and choke it off, and there are other things in which it tries to amplify, and in the end the atmosphere is rather better at solving its equations than we are, it seems to have a very clever way of getting itself to some extent out of trouble. It doesn't get too far from equilibrium, but you do get these things like the ozone hole, which is an anomaly. I mean, it's serious. It's not as serious as it has been made out to me. I mean, the effect on the ultraviolet light getting down to the ground, the UVB, which has biological effects, there's practically no change in measurement of the UV at the ground. Because, in fact, the ozone in the troposphere has increased due to motor cars and all the rest of it, you see. So it's the total amount of ozone that matters, from the ground right up to the stratosphere, that determines how much UV will get to the ground. So all this stuff that you talk about, increased cataracts and skin cancers and so on, due to that, I think is on very, very weak ground indeed. A lot of it comes from additional sunbathing. You cut out your sunbathing half an hour a day if you're in the tropics or subtropics. Make up for a lot. A slight increase in any UVB there may be. So these things do get out. People start to build on, you start from a weak scientific base, and they sort of pile hypothesis on hypothesis, and before you know where you are, the whole structure, you know, sort of gets out of hand. One has to take a very critical view of some of these things, and you have to rely on measurements. And as I say, there's very little evidence at all that the UVB getting to the ground has increased. And you know the reason for that is because the ozone in the troposphere, in the lower atmosphere, has substantially increased and offset the decrease in the stratosphere. Yes, you would.
Can you look at the changes in water vapor contents, and how much does that matter?
Oh yes, of course. I mean, that's absolutely crucial. I mean, the water vapor is calculated. So I said we calculate the humidity at each point, and we have to get that to get the clouds right, to get the rainfall right, and so on. And then the effect of the water vapor, increased water vapor, on absorbing the infrared. It's all taken into account. That's crucial. If you don't get the water vapor right, you won't get your clouds right, you won't get your rain right, you won't get your radiation right, you won't get anything right. So that the water vapor is absolute crucial. It's more important than the CO2. Of course, the simple thing about the CO2, it's uniformly mixed everywhere. But the water vapor varies enormous. Just look at the sky. Yeah, that's right. Now that's all taken into account.
Just said that the global situation is remarkably stable, resilient mechanism, and yet in the small scale we know that it's highly chaotic.
Yes, of course.
Where does the ground lie? Space,
well.
And
well, if you're talking about deterministic prediction, now this means that you start with an initial observed state and you run your mathematical model to predict what's going to happen in the future. Cause and effect is it's a purely deterministic thing. There is a chaotic element in that, of course, because there's a lot of random turbulence and chaotic motion in the atmosphere. And that destroys the prediction, the deterministic prediction at some stage. We know from weather forecasting that somewhere about 1 or 2 weeks ahead. I think I said I was the first to say it about 1957, that I thought 2 weeks ahead was about the limit to which we could make a useful forecast, starting from the initial state and going through and making a deterministic forecast. And we're struggling to get beyond a week even now. We look as though something like 10 days, because the random chaotic motions accumulate. You can't take those into account in the model. You can't deal with these small-scale motions. But in the end, they accumulate and destroy the forecast. So that as far as deterministic forecasting is concerned. Now, what do you do beyond that? Can you do nothing beyond that? Can you say nothing about the weather beyond 10 days or 2 weeks? Yes, I think you can. Because what you do then, you bring in a probabilistic element. You don't say black and white, this is what will happen from this initial condition in a deterministic sense. What you're actually doing at Bracknell now, to deal with that problem, they start off the weather from a particular observed state, and they run the model for, say, 2 or 3 weeks. But they just don't do one forecast. They change the initial condition slightly and run it again. And so you get what we call an ensemble of forecasts. We get starting from, say, noon today, with slightly different input conditions, you might have a dozen forecasts. Now, if they all keep very close to one another, you'll say that the atmosphere is in a reasonably stable mode, you have high confidence in the forecast, and there's some determinism that's being preserved. If they diverge, as they do on other occasions, then the chaotic motions take over, and you've got very low probability. And you have to tell the public, you know, you have to start talking in terms of odds. If you go beyond, and that's quite valuable because, you know, that's better than saying nothing at all. I mean, you could say something about it. You could say something about the tracks of the major depressions, even if you didn't get the movements of the individual depressions right, for example. So that's what you do in the medium term. Now, the climate problem is very different, you see, because what we're doing is we're calculating these things every 20 minutes. But we're averaging over a month, and a season, and a year, and a decade. So because you're averaging out a lot at that smaller scale, shorter time scale chaotic motion. And that's the difference between climate and weather. Right?
Yes, but what was worrying me was whether there might be a chaotic element in the global prediction of the climate as well.
Well, there'll certainly be some there, as I say, because you see, the climate model gives you natural variability. You see, it's not the same year by year, and neither it is in the real atmosphere. So the model has got to take into account the natural fluctuations from year to year. But of course, if you smooth it over 10 years, or you keep taking averages, you see. And that's why, to some extent, you take that variability out. But when you make a prediction, you have to make a prediction not only what's going to happen to the average values, but you've got to say something about the variability. That's to guide the customer. You've got to say, well, the average temperature change is going to be this, but plus or minus this on what time scale you're talking about. And that's why it's very important that the model gets the variability right, as well as the average values. And that took a long time. And we were the first of the Met Office to push that home. Of course, it was a lot of computing time, a lot of sweat to actually do that. But just to give average values with no idea of the variability isn't very helpful and not very meaningful, as a matter of fact. Well, I think the permanent gases, the nitrogen and oxygen, the variations, of course, on a local scale they can vary, but they're negligible. In any case, they aren't active gases, you see, from our point of view. They aren't strong, well, there's some weak bands in oxygen, but they aren't strong absorbers like the CO2, so the permanent gases don't matter very much. CO2, of course, is permanent gas. That's the one that really matters. Uniformly distributed. Of course, they're local sources on the ground, but by and large, it's uniform. You can see the same thing, the concentration is uniform through the atmosphere. And that makes it much easier to deal with than things like water vapor, which is enormously variable. But as far as nitrogen and oxygen and the argon, they really don't come into the matter. Ozone does, and that's again a very variable. The whole thing about analytic chemistry for about these minor trace gases is just revolutionized in the last. I mean, we couldn't found the CFCs 20 years ago. I mean, Jim Lovelock, he was on, I don't know if you saw him on the box the other night, he's the man who invented the instrument for measuring things like CFC. I mean, we're talking about a few parts in a trillion. And, you know, we didn't know those things were there. Half the scares we get now, you know, the impurities of water to one part in a billion, whatever. We didn't know it was there. We couldn't measure it before. We'll get worked up about it. All living till we're too old, probably. So you can, these things do, you know, they can, in a sense, get out of, just because you can detect it in these tiny quantities. Getting that to the biological effects and so on is a big step. And I think we need a much more critical approach to some of these things and get away from the emotion and the newspaper headlines and too much of the science these days, I'm afraid, is being driven that way like everything else. And I have to say that some scientists are not above reproach in the way that they capitalise on this, in my opinion. You remember 15 years ago we were going to have an instant ice age. Mm-hmm. And you remember, if you just looked at that graph of the temperature, this is just point.